The Secret of Chimneys, Agatha Christie. Chapter 23, Encounter in the Rose Garden. At 2:30, a little party met together in the council chamber. Bundle, Virginia, Superintendent Battle, Monsieur Lemoine, and Anthony Cade. "No good waiting until we can get hold of Mr. Lomax," said Battle. "This is the kind of business one wants to get on with quickly. If you've got any idea that Prince Michael was murdered by someone who got in this way, you're wrong," said Bundle. "It can't be done. The other end's blocked completely." "There's no question of that, m'lady," said Lemoine quickly. "It's quite a different search that we make." "Looking for something, are you?" asked Bundle quickly. "Not the historic whatnot, by any chance?" Lemoine looked puzzled. "Explain yourself, Bundle," said Virginia encouragingly. "You can when you try." "The thingamabob," said Bundle. "The historic diamond of purple princes that was pinched in the dark ages before I grew to years of discretion." "Who told you this, Lady Eileen?" asked Battle. "I've always known. One of the footmen told me when I was 12 years old." "A footman?" said Battle. "Lord! I'd like Mr. Lomax to have heard that." "It's one of George's closely guarded secrets?" asked Bundle. "How perfectly screaming! I never really thought it was true. George always was an ass. He must know that servants know everything." She went across to the Holbein portrait, touched a spring concealed somewhere at the side of it, and immediately, with a creaking noise, a section of the paneling swung inwards, revealing a dark opening. "Entrez, monsieur et madame," said Bundle dramatically. "Walk up, walk up, walk up, dearies. Best show of the season, and only a tanner." Both Lemoine and Battle were provided with torches. They entered the dark aperture first, the others close on their heels. "Air's nice and fresh," remarked Battle. "Must be ventilated somehow." He walked on ahead. The floor was rough, uneven stone, but the walls were bricked. As Bundle had said, the passage extended for a bare 100 yards. Then it came to an abrupt end with a fallen heap of masonry. Battle satisfied himself that there was no way of egress beyond, and then spoke over his shoulder. "We'll go back, if you please. I wanted just to spy out the land, so to speak." In a few minutes, they were back again at the paneled entrance. "We'll start from here," said Battle. 7 straight, 8 left, 3 right. Take the first as paces." He paced 7 steps carefully, and bending down, examined the ground. "About right, I should fancy. At one time or another, there's been a chalk mark made here. Now then, 8 left. That's not paces. The passage is only wide enough to go Indian file anyway." "Say it in bricks," suggested Anthony. "Quite right, Mr. Cade. 8 bricks from the bottom or the top on the left-hand side. Try from the bottom first. It's easier." He counted up 8 bricks. "Now 3 to the right of that. 1, 2, 3. Hello, hello, what's this?" "I shall scream in a minute," said Bundle. "I know I shall. What is it?" Superintendent Battle was working at the brick with the point of his knife. His practiced eye had quickly seen that this particular brick was different from the rest. A minute or two's work, and he was able to pull it right out. Behind was a small dark cavity. Battle thrust in his hand. Everyone waited in breathless expectancy. Battle drew out his hand again. He uttered an exclamation of surprise and anger. The others crowded round and stared uncomprehendingly at the 3 articles he held. For a moment, it seemed as though their eyes must have deceived them. A card of small pearl buttons, a square of coarse knitting, and a piece of paper, on which were inscribed a row of capital E's. "Well," said Battle, "I'm danged. What's the meaning of this?" "Mon Dieu," muttered the Frenchman. "Ça c'est un peu trop fort." "But what does it mean?" cried Virginia, bewildered. "Mean," said Anthony. There's only one thing it can mean. The late Count Stilpich must have had a sense of humor. There's an example of that humor. I may say that I don't consider it particularly funny myself. Do you mind explaining your meaning a little more clearly, sir? Said the superintendent Battle. Certainly. This was the Count's little joke. He must have suspected that his memorandum had been read. When the crooks came to recover the jewel, they were to find instead this extremely clever conundrum. It's the sort of thing you pin to yourself at book teas. Then people have to guess what you are. It has a meaning, then? I should say, undoubtedly. If the Count had meant to be merely offensive, he would have put a placard with "sold" on it, or a picture of a donkey, or something crude like that. A bit of knitting, some capital E's, and a lot of buttons, muttered Battle discontentedly. C'est un oui, said Lemoine angrily. Cipher number 2, said Anthony. I wonder whether Professor Winwood would be any good at this one. When was this passage last used, m'lady? Asked the Frenchman of Bundle. Bundle reflected. I don't believe anyone's been into it for over 2 years. The Priest's Hole is the show exhibit for Americans and tourists generally. Curious, murmured the Frenchman. Why curious? Lemoine stooped and picked up a small object from the floor. Because of this, he said. This match has not lain here for 2 years, not even 2 days. Any of you ladies or gentlemen drop this, by any chance? He asked. He received a negative all round. Well then, said Superintendent Battle, we've seen all there is to see. We might as well get out of here. The proposal was assented to by all. The panel had swung to, but Bundle showed them how it was fastened from the inside. She unlatched it, swung it noiselessly open, and sprang through the opening, alighting in the council chamber with a resounding thud. Damn, said Lord Cadogan, springing up from an armchair in which he appeared to have been taking 40 winks. Poor old father, said Bundle. Did I startle you? I can't think, said Lord Cadogan, why nobody nowadays ever sits still after a meal. It's a lost art. God knows chimneys is big enough, but even here there doesn't seem to be a single room where I can be sure of a little peace. Good Lord, how many of you are there? Reminds me of the pantomimes I used to go to as a boy, when hordes of demons used to pop up out of trapdoors. Demon number 7, said Virginia, approaching him and patting him on the head. Don't be cross. We're just exploring secret passages, that's all. There seems to be a positive boom in secret passages today, grumbled Lord Cadogan, not yet completely mollified. I've had to show that fellow fish round them all morning. When was that? Asked Battle quickly. Just before lunch. Seems he'd heard of the one in here. I showed him that, and then took him up to the White Gallery, and we finished up with the Priest's Hole. But his enthusiasm was waning by that time. He looked bored to death. But I made him go through with it. Lord Cadogan chuckled at the remembrance. Anthony put a hand on Lemoine's arm. Come outside, he said softly. I want to speak to you. The two men went out together through the window. When they'd gone a sufficient distance from the house, Anthony drew from his pocket the scrap of paper that Boris had given him that morning. Look here, he said. Did you drop this? Lemoine looked at it and examined it with some interest. No, he said. I've never seen it before. Why? Quite sure? Absolutely sure, monsieur. That's very odd. He repeated to Lemoine what Boris had said. The other listened with close attention. No, I did not drop it. You say he found it in that clump of trees. Well, I assume so, but he didn't actually say so. It is just possible that it might have fluttered out of Monsieur Eisenstein's suitcase. Question Boris again. He handed the paper back to Anthony. After a minute or two, he said, What exactly do you know of this man Boris? Anthony shrugged his shoulders. I understood he was the late Prince Michael's trusted servant. It may be so, but make it your business to find out. Ask someone who knows, such as the Baron Lolo Pretzel. Perhaps this man was engaged but a few weeks ago. For myself, I have believed him honest, but who knows? King Victor is quite capable of making himself into a trusted servant at a moment's notice. Do you really think? Lemoine interrupted him. I will be quite frank. With me, King Victor is an obsession. I see him everywhere. At this moment, even I ask myself, this man who is talking to me, this Mr. Cade, is he perhaps King Victor? Good Lord, said Anthony, you've got it badly. What do I care for the diamond, the discovery of the murder of Prince Michael? I leave those affairs to my colleague of Scotland Yard, whose business it is. Me? I am in England for one purpose, and one purpose only, to capture King Victor, and capture him red-handed. Nothing else matters. Think you'll do it? Said Anthony, lighting a cigarette. How should I know? Said Lemoine, with sudden despondency. Said Anthony. They had regained the terrace. Superintendent Battle was standing near the French window in a wooden attitude. Look at poor Battle, said Anthony. Let's go and cheer him up. He paused a minute and said, You know, you're an odd fish in some ways, Monsieur Lemoine. In what ways, Monsieur Cade? Well, said Anthony, in your place, I should have been inclined to note down that address that I showed you. It may be of no importance, quite conceivably. On the other hand, it might be very important indeed. Lemoine looked at him for a minute or two, steadily. Then, with a slight smile, he drew back the cuff of his left coat sleeve. Penciled on the white shirt cuff beneath were the words, Hurstmere, Langley Road, Dover. I apologize, said Anthony. And I retire worsted. He joined Superintendent Battle. You look very pensive, Battle, he remarked. I've got a lot to think about, Mr. Cade. Yes, I expect you have. Things aren't dovetailing. They're not dovetailing at all. Very trying, sympathized Anthony. Never mind, Battle. If the worst comes to the worst, you can always arrest me. You've got my guilty footprints to fall back upon, remember? But the superintendent didn't smile. Got any enemies here that you know of, Mr. Cade? He asked. I've got an idea that the third footman doesn't like me, replied Anthony lightly. He does his best to forget to hand me the choicest vegetables. Why? I've been getting anonymous letters, said Superintendent Battle. Or rather, an anonymous letter, I should say. About me? Without answer, Battle took a folded sheet of cheap notebook paper from his pocket and handed it to Anthony. Scrawled on it, in an illiterate handwriting, were the words, Look out for Mr. Cade. He isn't what he seems. Anthony handed it back with a light laugh. That all? Cheer up, Battle. I'm really a king in disguise, you know. He went into the house, whistling lightly as he walked along. But as he entered his bedroom and shut the door behind him, his face changed. It grew set and stern. He sat down on the edge of the bed and stared moodily at the floor. Things are getting serious, said Anthony to himself. Something must be done about it. It's all damned awkward. He sat there for a minute or two, then strolled to the window. For a moment or two, he stood looking out aimlessly, and then his eyes became suddenly focused on a certain spot, and his face lightened. Of course, he said, the rose garden. That's it, the rose garden. He hurried downstairs again and out into the garden by a side door. He approached the rose garden by a circuitous route. It had a little gate at either end. He entered by the far one and walked up to the sundial, which was on a raised hillock in the exact center of the garden. Just as Anthony reached it, he stopped dead and stared at another occupant of the rose garden who seemed equally surprised to see him. "I didn't know that you were interested in roses, Mr. Fish," said Anthony gently. "Sir," said Mr. Fish, "I am considerably interested in roses." They looked at each other warily, as antagonists seek to measure their opponent's strength. "So am I," said Anthony. "Is that so? In fact, I dote upon roses," said Anthony airily. A very slight smile hovered upon Mr. Fish's lips, and at the same time Anthony also smiled. The tension seemed to relax. "Look at this beauty now," said Mr. Fish, stooping to point out a particularly fine bloom. "Madame Abel Châtenay, I presume it to be. Yes, I'm right. This white rose, before the war, was known as Frau Karl Drusky. They have, I believe, renamed it. Oversensitive, perhaps, but truly patriotic. The La France is always popular. Do you care for red roses at all, Mr. Cade? A bright scarlet rose, now." Mr. Fish's slow, drawling voice was interrupted. Bundle was leaning out of a first-floor window. "Care for a spin to town, Mr. Fish? I'm just off." "Thank you, Lady Eileen, but I am very happy here." "Sure you won't change your mind, Mr. Cade?" Anthony laughed and shook his head. Bundle disappeared. "Sleep is more in my line," said Anthony with a wide yawn. "A good after-luncheon nap." He took out a cigarette. "You haven't got a match, have you?" Mr. Fish handed him a matchbox. Anthony helped himself and handed back the box with a word of thanks. "Roses," said Anthony, "are all very well, but I don't feel particularly horticultural this afternoon." With a disarming smile, he nodded cheerfully. A thundering noise sounded from just outside the house. "Pretty powerful engine she's got in that car of hers," remarked Anthony. "There, off she goes." They had a view of the car speeding down the long drive. Anthony yawned again and strolled towards the house. He passed in through the door. Once inside, he seemed as though changed to quicksilver. He raced across the hall, out through one of the windows on the farther side, and across the park. Bundle, he knew, had to make a big detour by the lodge gates and through the village. He ran desperately. It was a race against time. He reached the park wall just as he heard the car outside. He swung himself up and dropped into the road. "Hi!" cried Anthony. In her astonishment, Bundle swerved half across the road. She managed to pull up without accident. Anthony ran after the car, opened the door, and jumped in beside Bundle. "I'm coming to London with you," he said. "I meant to all along." "Extraordinary person," said Bundle. "What's that you've got in your hand?" "Only a match," said Anthony. He regarded it thoughtfully. It was pink, with a yellow head. He threw away his unlighted cigarette and put the match carefully into his pocket. Chapter 24. The House at Dover. "You don't mind, I suppose," said Bundle after a minute or two, "if I drive rather fast. I started later than I meant to do." It had seemed to Anthony that they were proceeding at a terrific speed already, but he soon saw that that was nothing compared to what Bundle could get out of the Panhard if she tried. "Some people," said Bundle as she slowed down momentarily to pass through a village, "are terrified of my driving. Poor old father, for instance. Nothing would induce him to come up with me in this old bus." Privately, Anthony thought Lord Cadaham was entirely justified. Driving with Bundle was not a sport to be indulged in by nervous, middle-aged gentlemen. "But you don't seem nervous a bit," continued Bundle approvingly as she swept around a corner on two wheels. "I'm in pretty good training, you see," explained Anthony gravely. "Also," he added as an afterthought, "I'm rather in a hurry myself." "Shall I speed her up a bit more?" asked Bundle kindly. "Good Lord, no," said Anthony hastily. "We're averaging about 50 as it is." "I'm burning with curiosity to know the reason for this sudden departure," said Bundle, after executing a fanfare upon the klaxon which must temporarily have deafened the neighborhood. But I suppose I mustn't ask. You're not escaping from justice, are you?
I'm not quite sure, said Anthony. I shall know soon.
That Scotland Yard man isn't as much of a rabbit as I thought, said Bundle, thoughtfully.
Battle's a good man, agreed Anthony.
You ought to have been in diplomacy, remarked Bundle. You don't part with much information, do you?
I was under the impression that I babbled.
Oh, boy! You're not eloping with Mademoiselle Brune by any chance.
Not guilty, said Anthony with fervor. There was a pause of some minutes during which Bundle caught up and passed three other cars. Then she asked suddenly,
How long have you known Virginia?
That's a difficult question to answer, said Anthony with perfect truth. I haven't actually met her very often, and yet I seem to have known her a long time.
Bundle nodded.
Virginia's got brains, she remarked abruptly. She's always talking nonsense, but she's got brains all right. She was frightfully good out in Herzegovina, I believe. If Tim Revel had lived, he'd have had a fine career, and mostly owing to Virginia. She worked for him tooth and nail. She did everything in the world she could for him, and I know why, too.
Because she cared for him, Anthony sat, looking very straight ahead of him.
No, because she didn't. Don't you see? She didn't love him. She never loved him. And so she did everything on earth she could to make up. That's Virginia all over. But don't you make any mistake about it. Virginia was never in love with Tim Revel.
You seem very positive, said Anthony, turning to look at her.
Bundle's little hands were clenched on the steering wheel, and her chin was stuck out in a determined manner.
I know a thing or two. I was only a kid at the time of her marriage, but I heard one or two things, and knowing Virginia, I can put them together easily enough. Tim Revel was bowled over by Virginia. He was Irish, you know, and most attractive, and a genius for expressing himself well. Virginia was quite young, 18. She couldn't go anywhere without seeing Tim in a state of picturesque misery, vowing he'd shoot himself or take to drink if she didn't marry him. Girls believe these things, or used to. We've advanced a lot in the last 8 years. Virginia was carried away by the feeling she thought she'd inspired. She married him, and she was an angel to him always. She wouldn't have been half as much of an angel if she'd loved him. There's a lot of devil in Virginia, but I can tell you one thing. She enjoys her freedom, and anyone will have a hard time persuading her to give it up.
I wonder why you tell me all this, said Anthony slowly.
It's interesting to know about people, isn't it?
Some people, that is.
I've wanted to know, he acknowledged. And you'd never have heard from Virginia. But you can trust me for an inside tip from the stables. Virginia's a darling. Even women like her, because she isn't a bit of a cat. And anyway, Bundle ended, somewhat obscurely, one must be a sport, mustn't one?
Oh, certainly, Anthony agreed. But he was still puzzled. He had no idea what had prompted Bundle to give him so much information unasked. That he was glad of it, he didn't deny.
Here are the trams, said Bundle with a sigh. Now, I suppose I shall have to drive carefully.
It might be as well, agreed Anthony. His ideas and Bundle's on the subject of careful driving hardly coincided. Leaving indignant suburbs behind them, they finally emerged into Oxford Street.
Not bad going, eh? Said Bundle, glancing at her wristwatch.
Anthony assented fervently.
Where do you want to be dropped?
Anywhere. Which way are you going?
Knightsbridge way.
All right. Drop me at Hyde Park Corner.
Goodbye, said Bundle as she drew up at the place indicated. What about the return journey?
I'll find my own way back. Thanks very much.
I have scared him, remarked Bundle.
I shouldn't recommend driving with you as a tonic for nervous old ladies, but personally, I've enjoyed it. The last time I was in equal danger was when I was charged by a herd of wild elephants.
I think you're extremely rude, remarked Bundle. We've not even had one bump today.
"I'm sorry if you've been holding yourself in on my account," retorted Anthony. "I don't think men are really very brave," said Bundle. "That's a nasty one," said Anthony. "I retire, humiliated." Bundle nodded and drove on. Anthony hailed a passing taxi. "Victoria Station," he said to the driver as he got in. When he got to Victoria, he paid off the taxi and inquired for the next train to Dover. Unfortunately, he had just missed one. Resigning himself to a wait of something over an hour, Anthony paced up and down, his brows knit. Once or twice, he shook his head impatiently. The journey to Dover was uneventful. Arrived there, Anthony passed quickly out of the station, and then, as though suddenly remembering, he turned back again. There was a slight smile on his lips as he asked to be directed to Hurstmere, Langley Road. The road in question was a long one, leading right out of the town. According to the porter's instructions, Hurstmere was the last house. Anthony trudged along steadily. The little pucker had reappeared between his eyes. Nevertheless, there was a new elation in his manner, as always when danger was near at hand. Hurstmere was, as the porter had said, the last house in Langley Road. It stood well back, enclosed in its own grounds, which were ragged and overgrown. The place, Anthony judged, must have been empty for many years. A large iron gate swung rustily on its hinges, and the name on the gatepost was half obliterated. "A lonely spot," muttered Anthony to himself, "and a good one to choose." He hesitated a minute or two, glanced quickly up and down the road, which was quite deserted, and then slipped quietly past the creaking gate into the overgrown drive. He walked up it a little way, and then stood listening. He was still some distance from the house. Not a sound could be heard anywhere. Some fast yellowing leaves detached themselves from one of the trees overhead, and fell with a soft rustling sound that was almost sinister in the stillness. Anthony started, then smiled. "Nerves," he murmured to himself. "Never knew I had such things before." He went on up the drive. Presently, as the drive curved, he slipped into the shrubbery and so continued his way unseen from the house. Suddenly he stood still, peering out through the leaves. Some distance away a dog was barking, but it was a sound nearer at hand that had attracted Anthony's attention. His keen hearing had not been mistaken. A man came rapidly round the corner of the house, a short, square, thick-set man, foreign in appearance. He didn't pause, but walked steadily on, circling the house and disappearing again. Anthony nodded to himself. "Sentry," he murmured. "They do the thing quite well." As soon as he'd passed, Anthony went on, diverging to the left, and so following in the footsteps of the sentry. His own footsteps were quite noiseless. The wall of the house was on his right, and presently he came to where a broad blur of light fell on the graveled walk. The sound of several men talking together was clearly audible. "My God, what double-dyed idiots," murmured Anthony to himself. "It would serve them right to be given a fright." He stole up to the window, stooping a little so that he should not be seen. Presently, he lifted his head very carefully to the level of the sill and looked in. Half a dozen men were sprawling round a table. Four of them were big, thick-set men, with high cheekbones and eyes set in Magyar slanting fashion. The other two were rat-like little men with quick gestures. The language that was being spoken was French, but the four big men spoke it with uncertainty and a hoarse, guttural intonation. "The boss," growled one of these. "When will he be here?" One of the smaller men shrugged his shoulders. "Any time now." "About time, too," growled the first man. "I've never seen him, this boss of yours, but, oh, what great and glorious work might we not have accomplished in these days of idle waiting?" "Fool," said the other man bitingly. "Getting nabbed by the police is all the great and glorious work you and your precious lot would have been likely to accomplish. A lot of blundering guerrillas.
Aha! Roared another big, thick-set fellow. You insult the comrades. I will soon set the sign of the Red Hand round your throat.
He half rose, glaring ferociously at the Frenchman, but one of his companions pulled him back again.
No quarreling, he grunted. We're to work together. From all I heard, this King Victor doesn't stand for being disobeyed.
In the darkness, Anthony heard the footsteps of the sentry coming his round again, and he drew back behind a bush.
Who's that? Said one of the men inside.
Carlo, going his rounds.
Oh, what about the prisoner?
He's all right, coming round pretty fast now. He's recovered well from the crack on the head we gave him. Anthony moved gently away.
God, what a lot, he muttered. They discuss their affairs with an open window, and that fool Carlo goes his round with the tread of an elephant and the eyes of a bat. And to crown all, the Herzoslovakians and the French are on the point of coming to blows. King Victor's headquarters seem to be in a parlous condition. It would amuse me very much, to teach them a lesson.
He stood irresolute for a minute, smiling to himself. From somewhere above his head came a stifled groan. Anthony looked up. The groan came again. Anthony glanced quickly from left to right. Carlo was not too round just yet. He grasped the heavy Virginia creeper and climbed nimbly till he reached the sill of a window. The window was shut, but with a tool from his pocket, he soon succeeded in forcing up the catch. He paused a minute to listen, then sprang lightly inside the room. There was a bed in the far corner, and on that bed a man was lying, his figure barely discernible in the gloom. Anthony went over to the bed and flashed his pocket torch on the man's face. It was a foreign face, pale and emaciated, and the head was swathed in heavy bandages. The man was bound hand and foot. He stared up at Anthony like one dazed. Anthony bent over him, and as he did so, he heard a sound behind him and swung round, his hand traveling to his coat pocket. But a sharp command arrested him.
Hands up, sonny. You didn't expect to see me here, but I happened to catch the same train as you at Victoria.
It was Hiram Fish, who was standing in the big doorway. He was smiling, and in his hand was a big blue automatic.